So I wanted to go back and emphasize one thing that I think is a possible source of confusion at the beginning, and that is this distinction between formulas and equations. So somehow formulas is what you would expect to put into a theory or a type, and that doesn't quite make sense. What does make sense, if you're thinking of a theory of a structure, theory of some M, then what makes sense is to evaluate a given sentence in M, which comes out to be some real number between 0 and 1, and then put the equation sigma equals that value. If the number is R, put in the equation sigma equals R into the theory. That tells you in a simple way what sigma means in some sense. This is, of course, exactly what we do when we make a theory in ordinary model theory. We take a sentence, and we evaluate it, and if the sentence comes out true, we put that sentence in the theory, and if the sentence comes out false, well, because of something else that we do, we put the negation of the sentence in the theory. So in some sense, we put in the equation either sigma equals 1 for truth or sigma equals 0 for falsity explicitly in the theory. Same thing for types, except it's the theory of an expanded structure that we're talking about. And in this setting, it's often convenient, and it will be in the next topics that I'm taking up, to normalize all these equations so that they assert some sentence equals 0. So that's what's explained here in the middle. In the special case that I was thinking about, where phi is a sentence and then c is its value in some structure, this would be the equation phi equals r for some particular r. And so this would be absolute phi minus r equals 0. The simplest way to say that the value of phi is forced in the theory or by the theory to be this particular real number r. Formulas, on the other hand, in general, define predicates. So they are the building blocks for getting the collection of all definable predicates. So at the end of the last hour, I had finished talking about the ultraproduct construction and the fundamental theorem that connects it to this logic. And one of the basic tools of model theory, which has its counterpart here then, that follows, that can be proved using that construction, is the compactness theorem. And the compactness theorem has a particular form that perhaps has some slightly unexpected elements that make it seem a little stronger than usual compactness theorem. So at the beginning, we have some set of equations, right? So it's a theory or a partial type if we allow some variables that we should be trying to satisfy in some structure. So that means it's equations that come into the compactness theorem. If we have no variables, we have some theory, we might be trying to specify for each sentence sigma its value. So we would have a lot of equations like sigma equals r, where r is some particular choice depending on which sigma we're talking about. And then one would be interested in finding a structure that simultaneously satisfies all those constraints. That's the kind of thing that should come up in the compactness theorem. So we have capital sigma, a set of equations, and in general, we want to allow an unlimited sequence or family of free variables, possible free variables, not just finite. Then, so these equations are of the form phi equals c, where the free variables occurring are not mentioned. And we want to make the absolute, in our eventual structure, we want to find, we want to satisfy the constraint phi equals c, which is the same thing as making absolute phi minus c equals 0. So into this set sigma plus, we don't put that equation, but all possible weakenings of it. That is, for an arbitrary positive epsilon, we put this inequality. And I explained before how such inequalities are to be interpreted as equations. So that is an equation, right? It says the minimum of the absolute value of phi minus c and epsilon equals the absolute value of phi minus c. As an equation, that's how it looks. So this is one passes from sigma to this weakening of it, right? If we actually had realized sigma, all of these equations would be true in it, because In fact, for a model in, and choices of the of elements for the free variables in which sigma was true, then absolute phi minus c would interpret to zero, since that's less than epsilon in every case. So we say that sigma is consistent or finitely satisfied in models of T if for every finite subset of this modified set, sigma plus, we can find an interpretation that makes all the equations in that finite set true. In other words, for finitely many instances of problems like this, we can find a structure and interpretation of the free variables that makes this inequality true. So all these phi minus t's come out to be epsilon, less than or equal to epsilon, which of course means that phi and c differ by less than epsilon. Whatever values they come out to have, they differ by less than epsilon. And the compactness theorem is that whenever we have a theory and such a set of equations that's consistent with the theory, then there is a model and an interpretation of the free variables in which all the equations in the original set, not just the modified set, are true. Actually, if all the equations in sigma plus are true, then all the equations in sigma have to be true as well, because in that situation, absolute phi minus c would be less than or equal to every positive number epsilon, which means it has to be zero. It is some real number, after all, some positive, non-negative real number. So the compactness theorem is proved from this assumption of consistency using an ultra product of a familiar sort. That is, the elements of the points, the index set on which the ultra filter is built, so the index set for the ultra filter, will be the collection of all such sigma zeros. And if we're given a finite set of these equations, the hypothesis gives us an interpretation that makes it true. And so we simply make an appropriate ultra product of that family of structures to achieve this this end result. So what we have to do is make sure that our ultra filter forces or reflects the fact that these sigma zeros are converging to sigma plus, and that epsilon is converging to zero. And that dictates certain sets that should be in the ultra filter that are, it's probably best if I don't try to write down, but that are specified at the point in the notes where this theorem is discussed. So the compactness theorem then is, for this logic, is true in its full force. I think that if you had to guess what the compactness theorem said, you would guess this, except maybe you wouldn't put the sigma plus in. But that can be quite useful, however, to have that extra degree of approximation in the notion of finite satisfiability. Oops. Okay, so the compactness theorem is one of the sort of building block tools of model theory that one is used to employing, building and using non-standard models. And here are two more. Unions of chains formally looks like the usual statement of the union of an elementary chain. So we have a linear ordering, and for each point in the linear ordering, we have a structure. And we assume that when the points are ordered with lambda 2 bigger than lambda 1, then m lambda 2 is an elementary extension of m lambda 1. Now, so first of all, that includes the assumption that the bigger one is an extension, or the smaller one is a substructure. So that means that on the union structure, all the metric and all the interpretations of predicates and functions and the constants make sense. They have a coherent meaning. So that certainly means that on the union, we can erect at least the beginning of an L structure. We can build a metric space, which is the union of the metric spaces given to us in the M lambdas. Simply take the metric that is the direct limit of the given metrics. Do the same thing with the functions and the predicates. The constants are necessarily interpreted in the coherently in all the M lambdas. But being an L structure requires a bit more. We have to check that the bounds and the moduli of uniform continuity are correct. Someone has to think for a minute to make sure that that's okay, but it's quite routine. And then so then we have this union structure. And the claim, as in the usual statement in model theory, is that this union structure is an elementary extension of each of the m lambdas. So that goes like the usual proof, using the appropriate version of the Tarski-Vaught criterion for being an elementary substructure, carry through an induction that the right equivalence holds. Remember what elementary extension or elementary substructure means. It means that if we take some elements from M lambda and a formula phi, and we interpret the formula at those points in M lambda or in M, we get the same real number. So we have to prove that by induction on complexity of formulas, which means that we have to check cases. We have to particularly check cases involved with applying a continuous function or applying where there is something to think about, the sup and inf quantifiers are applied. But this is really quite routine. There are also Liebenheim-Skolem theorems that are useful. And so here, there's an issue about number of formulas that has to be addressed. So for example, fix in your mind for simplicity that L is countable. That means that L has countably many non-logical symbols, countably many functions, predicates, and constants. If we try to do the usual construction in which we would witness the requirement in the Tarski-Vaught criterion, we would keep putting elements into the model that we were trying to build from below to witness the truth of some existential condition. And if we think about the conclusion here, we want, in the case kappa equals omega, we want the structure that we build to have density less or equals omega. That means separable. Well, you might think that we would get into trouble because there are continuum many formulas to apply this Tarski-Vaught criterion to. And we don't see a priori how to do that and retain separability. A priori, it looks like we might have to throw in uncomfortably many witnesses for the Tarski-Vaught condition without any way to control the density of what we were putting in. So an important ingredient in this argument is that we really only have to take countably many formulas into account when the language is countable. That is to say, we really only have to take into account countably many connectives. For example, a set of connectives which is dense in the uniform topology. So for each k, we would look at the restricted set of formulas in which we use only, say, polynomial connectives. We know from the Weierstrass theorem that these are dense, and so we can approximate every connective uniformly by polynomials. And then if one carries through carefully an inductive argument, it follows that we can approximate formulas uniformly by formulas built up using polynomial connectives. That, again, requires some proof by induction. One has to see that the uniform approximation carries forward not just at the level of connectives, but also when we apply supininf. So this is another basic real analysis metric space issue that has to be considered here. Except for that, the proof of the downward Liebenheim-Skolem theorem is like the usual one. One goes through a countable list of formulas, closing the initial set A under the addition of elements which witness the Tarski-Vaught criterion. Except now the Tarski-Vaught criterion will be of an approximate nature. Maybe I'll write this on the blackboard. So this is the Tarski-Vaught condition. For elementary substructureness. So we have M a substructure. Maybe that's, I guess in this, it's the other way around, isn't it? N is inside M. There was an eraser here somewhere. Ah, good. It's probably less confusing if I keep the same letters. So we have a substructure. The end result of our construction will be a substructure by fiat. Then N is an elementary substructure of M, if and only if, for all L formulas, phi of x1 to xm y. So we have this one extra variable. And for all a1 to am in n, and now we come to the important part. For all b in m, there exists a c in n, such that in absolute value, phi m of a1 to an and b minus phi m of a1 to an and c is less than or equal to epsilon. And there should have been for all epsilon up here at the beginning. So that's what the Tarski-Watt criterion looks like. If you have a formula and you put in elements of the smaller model for all but one of the variables, and you put some element of the bigger model in for the last variable, then you can find something in the smaller structure such that the value of the formula doesn't change by more than an arbitrarily small amount when you replace one by the other, b by c. So if you take that criterion, and now you can prove by induction on formulas that under these circumstances, formulas with parameters from n get the same value in n as they do in m. And this is used for the sup and inf quantifier case. Right, so a condition like this ensures that if we were applying the sup quantifier to y in this formula, this ensures that we got the same value in m as in n. Right, whatever, if b is something which nearly achieves the sup over that variable in the bigger structure, then c will come close to the same value in the smaller structure. And vice versa, too, because it doesn't vary by much. Okay. Well, it's clear that the sup in the smaller structure would, if anything, be smaller than the sup in the bigger structure, because there are more things in the bigger structure to push the value up. So this criterion is also relevant to something I said earlier about a structure being an elementary substructure of its completion. It's clear that this condition is satisfied in such a case, because B can be approximated arbitrarily by C's from the smaller structure, and the formula is continuous. And similarly about taking the closure of an elementary substructure and still having an elementary substructure. So in particular in this situation, or in the situation of this theorem, that justifies this last remark to resonate back to that earlier thing. Without loss of generality, the elementary substructure can be taken to be closed in M, namely just take the closure, and it is automatically still an elementary substructure. In fact, it automatically still satisfies this criterion, easily seen. So, for example, we will use this kind of one of the consequences of the Löwenheim-Skolem theorem that will come up when we're studying some examples, which will happen on Monday, well, Tuesday especially, when Alex Bernstein talks in the morning, when we're trying to understand the models of some theory, all of the theories that we consider will be countable, I think. And so it means that we can pay attention to separable models and still have a full idea of what's going on model theoretically at least. So one of the characteristic modes of argument in model theory is the use of universal domains or monster models, saturated homogeneous models, and they exist and are used here in much the same manner. So here's what it means for a model to be saturated, and the theorem that such things exist. So here's the definition. We have an L structure M, and kappa is an infinite cardinal, and we say that it's kappa saturated if whenever we add a set of parameters from M of cardinality less than kappa. So we look at the language L of A and the structure in which names for those elements have been adjoined. Then whenever we have a set of formulas, we could take them just with one free variable, or we could take them with fewer than kappa free variables, it's equivalent. Whenever we have such a set of equations, rather, I think I said formula, In the language L of A, where A parameters are allowed, that's consistent with the theory of the structure, then it's actually satisfied there. And remember, consistent with can be taken to mean this finite satisfaction of the set sigma plus, where we weaken the equations in sigma some amount, arbitrarily small amount. So the theorem is that every structure has a kappa saturated elementary extension. What one has to do to prove that theorem is more or less the same as what one does in ordinary model theory. That is, you first have to prove that given any structure M, there's an extension, which you can get by compactness or by an ultra power construction, that realizes every type over M. Every one type would be sufficient. And then you iterate that through some well ordering that's longer than kappa and regular. So say to kappa plus if you need to. Take the union of that chain, which we know how to do, and then argue that by regularity of the length of the construction, every set of parameters that we would have to consider is actually being considered at some point, and hence the realization that we're looking for is in the next structure. And therefore, by the union of chains result, it's still a realization of the same formulas in the union structure as well. So there are some nice properties of you'll usually hear me talking, even when perhaps I don't need to, about omega 1 saturated structures. So even when they might only need to be omega saturated, or perhaps even something a little less than that. And there are a couple of reasons for that, especially the first one. And that is, if we have an omega 1 saturated structure, its metric space is automatically complete. And the way to see that is simply to realize the partial type of the limit of the sequence over the parameters coming from the sequence. So a priori, we need omega 1 saturation to do that, because the set of parameters might be countable. So here, in fact, is the partial type that one should try to realize. If you're given a Cauchy sequence in M and you want to prove that it has a limit, well, there's some epsilon n, of course, which is the supremum of all the distances of an to any later element of the sequence, right? The supremum of the distances for the later occurring sequences. If it's a Cauchy sequence, epsilon n goes to zero. And what you try to realize is this partial type that says that the distance from the needed x, the x that you're looking for, to an is less than or equal to epsilon n. And if you have finitely many of these, let's say with a set of n's coming from some finite set f, then it's realized, actually realized, by any L, where L is bigger than all the elements of f. So it is, in fact, consistent with the theory of this M. Therefore, by saturation, it's realized in the model, and that gives you a limit for the sequence. It's also true that these slightly confusing inf and sup quantifiers more or less go away in a saturated. Actually, here one doesn't need as much as omega 1 saturation. Because after all, if we fix some parameters for y, so I guess we need finite saturation or something, we need this A, however many elements A has, realizing the inf over x, phi of x A equals 0, will be done as soon as we can realize phi of x A less or equal epsilon for each epsilon. And if the inf really is zero, we can do that. If the inf is zero, then for each epsilon, we can find an x such that phi of x A is less than or equal to epsilon. And by omega saturation, we would get an actual realization that made that phi of B A equal zero. That's what this says here. So it's actually quite convenient then. Personally, I find these inf and sup quantifiers totally confusing. And it's really good to go to an omega 1 saturated model where you can use ordinary quantifier reasoning. Then, of course, you have to figure out, well, what would it mean? What that I just did in this omega 1 saturated model, what does it mean in the model that I really care about, this separable thing that isn't omega 1 saturated? But that's usually easier. I don't know. Maybe real analysts, by that I don't mean real versus complex. I mean real versus imaginary. Real versus alien or something. Maybe they are so well trained that they can think in terms of sups and infs, the rest of us think about for all in there exists. And so the last thing that we need for building universal domains, rich models in which to argue, is the strongly homogeneous structures. So the definition of strongly homogeneous is one that you probably all could give. If we have small sets inside M, so small means less than the of size less than the cardinal kappa that's specified in the degree of homogeneity, if we have two sets and we have an elementary map from one to the other, then it comes from an automorphism of the full structure. And the way we build these is, again, by a union of change argument. So, for example, if kappa is regular, we can assume that it is, then we would make a kappa long chain in which, going from stage alpha to stage alpha plus 1, we would simply take a very highly saturated elementary extension, say saturated more than the cardinality of the previous model, and do this through, take unions at limit stages, and use the union of change arguments all the way along to know that elementary extensions, everything is an elementary extension, then the union of the chain would necessarily be homogeneous. And that's proved by an argument much like what one does in ordinary model theory. If you have this elementary map, it's actually fully realized at some level of this construction. And so because the sets are small, they are fully available at some alpha stage of the construction. And now we have to do a back and forth construction using saturation to extend from each stage to the next, to extend the elementary map that we have to one that's fully defined either on the left side or the right side of our construction, alternating as we go up, exactly as one does this, or one of the ways to do it in usual model theory. And by a kappa universal domain, we will mean a model of a theory T that's simultaneously kappa saturated and strongly kappa homogeneous. So one of the things that's true about the... okay, I'll put this off a minute. Okay, so now I want to talk about type spaces, where some interesting new things come in. So I just want to talk about a complete theory. For me, that simply means, although there is an indirect characterization that I could talk about, it simply means it's a theory of some particular structure. So remember, that just means, basically, for each sentence, the theory says what its value is supposed to be. That's what a complete theory is. And the value should be the same as the one given by M. So if we have a set of parameters from M, so let's take M to be a kappa universal domain, a big model for this theory, and take a set of parameters that's small with respect to kappa, and enlarge the model by adding names for all those constants, and take the theory of that structure. Right? So this is this theory is what types over A depend on. So TA is what I write in here to indicate that fact, and the space of N types relative to this TA is simply all the N types, so the types of N tuples that are realized in this model MA. So these are each sets of equations. Again, what this type does for each E1 to EN is it takes a formula with N free variables, phi of X1 to XN, and specifies what its value should be, just as a theory does. But now these E's are taken into account. And these E's are taken into account, of course, in addition to the elements of A. So it's just like taking the theory of this structure with the E's additionally named. Now there are two important, well, there are lots and lots of important topologies on the space of types, more than you find in general in model theory. But these two are especially important. One is the logic topology, which corresponds to the formula defined, or the sometimes called stone topology, on type spaces in ordinary model theory. And the other is this D-metric topology, which you probably should see as a cousin of the discrete topology on type spaces. That is the metric that assigns distance 1 to distinct types. So counting density in ordinary model theory for that metric is just like counting period, counting cardinality. So how are these defined? So it isn't right to do exactly what one does in ordinary model theory. What would one do there? One would take a certain equation that was in a type. So I'm trying to define a neighborhood of a type. So I would take an equation, phi equals zero, that's in the type, and I would look at all the other types that contain that equation. That's not right. That won't be an open set. That won't have interior generally. So for example, imagine that you're in a norm space and you have an element of norm 1. Well, then there's an equation that witnesses that fact, right? That says norm x1 equals 1, or its zero-valued counterpart. And if you think a little bit about the continuity of formulas, you would realize that that particular set of types will not have any reasonable interior. It will sort of correspond to the surface of the unit ball, which is a thin set in the norm sense. So what should one do? Well, it's a kind of an approximation of that. A basic neighborhood of a type P depends on two things. A formula phi such that the equation phi equals zero is in P, so an equation that's true in the sense of P, or that's true in realizations of P, or at realizations of P, and then an epsilon. And instead of asserting phi equals zero, you assert that phi is less than or equal to epsilon. So you allow a little room, and you look at all the types Q that contain that formula, that equation. That's a basic neighborhood of P. Now, it's not an open set. It's not a basic open neighborhood of P. It's just a basic neighborhood of P. So for this topology, a set is defined to be open if for every P in it, there is some formula phi and some epsilon such that this basic neighborhood is contained in the set. That's how one usually gets the definition of a topology from this kind of basic neighborhood, which is not assumed to be, not required to be open. So this is the logic topology. What about the, I don't know if you can, is that readable? I guess so. So there's also a metric topology on the space of types, which is the topology induced by the distance on the space of realizations. After all, since I've assumed that my model is a universal domain, there's a map, the type map, from M to the N onto the space of N types. Right? For each element of M to the N, I simply take the type that element realizes over A, and that's an element of Sn of Ta. So that's a surjective map. So it makes sense to induce a metric on the image from the metric on Mn. By the way, I think I didn't say specifically what metric on Mn we take. They're all equivalent, of course, all the reasonable ones. We have a given metric on each coordinate M, and so we simply take the maximum of those metric values coordinate by coordinate. So the L infinity sum or product of these factors. And so that's what I mean here as well. The distance between two types then is found by taking all possible realizations in our monster model, A for P, B for Q, looking at the distance between them and taking the infimum. So in ordinary metric terms, what we're doing is up in Mn, we're looking at the set of all realizations of P and the set of all realizations of Q and taking the distance between them. That's the distance between the types. So, okay. It could be, right? So I guess it pretty obviously is symmetric, non-negative, and satisfies the triangle inequality. Right? Every freshman in my honors analysis class should be able to prove that much. Why is it truly a metric? It is. And this comes from the way we defined it comes from the fact that formulas are continuous. So if they really are different, there will be some formula that has value 0 at a realization of P and 1 at a realization of Q. Now, if we look at something that's very near to a realization of P, well, the value of that formula is going to be very close to 0. Whereas if we look at something that's very close to Q, the value is going to be very close to 1 because of uniform continuity. And so P and Q can't be the same. I mean, P and Q can't even be limits of the same thing. So it has to be some appreciable distance between their sets of realizations. And how far we have to go to distance them depends on the modulus of uniform continuity of the formula that separates the types.
Y, 0 and 1, y,
1. Well, this is an artifice of these connectives. If I have a formula that's A at one of them and B at the other one, and B is only a little bit bigger than A, there's a continuous function that moves A to 0 and B to 1, right, with a steep enough slope in between. So I'd use that connective to get a different formula. Okay, any other questions?
If you replace smaller or equal to epsilon by smaller to epsilon, you get an open neighborhood, do you?
Not necessarily. In the logic topology, you mean?
Yeah.
Might be the same. The metric might have some little gap in its values. No, it's not generally open, and for other reasons. I don't have a great example quick to mind. I'll think of one by Monday. Ask me again. Okay, so this slide has on it, I guess I should put this definition somewhere. Okay, so it's sort of important to understand these topologies. There's a list of their properties. So the logic topology, first one defined there, is compact Hausdorff. Hausdorff should follow from more or less the answer I gave to Kobe's question. That is, if we have two points, P and Q, distinct points in the type space, I can find a formula that has the value 0 at P and 1 at Q, and by choosing epsilon less than a half, I can get logic neighborhoods of them both that are disjoint. So if phi equals 0 is in P, then phi comma 1/3, maybe 1/2 is enough, is a neighborhood of P. And then I have to modify phi to 1 minus phi, so that it's 0 at Q. And that comma 1/3 is a logic neighborhood of Q, and they're disjoint. Because phi can't simultaneously have a value that's less than or equal to 1/3 and greater than or equal to 2/3. So there's no realization of anything that produces a type in their overlap. And compactness, well, that's just the compactness theorem. Leave that as an exercise. Question? No. Okay.
So just in terms of this whole cat's business.
Yeah, so where shall I write? So if let's suppose we have P and Q in Sn over some parameters, and they're distinct. Well, then there's a formula phi with the property that phi equals 0 is in P, and phi equals 1 is in Q. Okay? And now I look at phi comma 1/3, and I look at 1 minus phi and 1/3. These are disjoint because if there was anything in them both, a type in them both would have to have phi less or equals 1/3, but greater than or equal to 2/3. That can't happen. And P is in this set and Q is in this set. P is not only in it, but it's in the interior. This is a neighborhood of P. And compactness of the space is the compactness theorem. you know, in the usual, you have to fiddle with the epsilons. Actually, Yves Reynal asked me that about that at lunch today. Just remember how it goes in ordinary logic, right? Without the continuity. So, what you have to do is take an open cover of Sn and produce a finite subcover. And it's sufficient for each type P to have a formula sigma P that's in P. And then that defines a neighborhood, and you have to find finitely many of these neighborhoods that are covering the whole space. So suppose it doesn't happen. Look at the set of negation sigma P's. That's finitely satisfied because each finite set fails to cover the type space. The formulas of sigma P fail to cover the type space, but it can't be satisfied because every type refutes one of these formulas. So it's the same thing here, except you have to take the epsilons into account. The neighborhood has an epsilon in it, the neighborhood that you would be trying to work with. Okay, the logic topology is coarser than the D-metric topology. That comes from uniform continuity of formulas. So if you have one of these phi epsilon neighborhoods of P, and you specify the so phi defines a uniformly continuous function, so you can force phi to change by less than epsilon prime by requiring that the points at which phi is evaluated move less than delta, and that means that anything within delta of the type P of which phi epsilon was a neighborhood will be in phi epsilon plus epsilon prime. Because the value can't change by more than epsilon prime. So that's a delta neighborhood that's contained in if epsilon plus epsilon prime is equal to epsilon, meaning epsilon and epsilon prime should be epsilon over 2, then you got you can make this fit with the neighborhood that you might have wanted to start with. Epsilon plus epsilon prime is an arbitrary positive number. Amador.
But you're working with real sets. Would it make a difference to work with sets with a given, I mean, like a density that is smaller than the kappa that you're considering? For example, like, I mean, the way that you define the saturation and things like this, you're working with a set of cardinality less than kappa. Would it make a difference to consider sets that has a dense set of cardinality less than kappa?
Maybe something that I say at the end will answer your question. If I understood your question right, starting with A of cardinality less than kappa and starting with A of density less than kappa, that really makes no difference. That makes no difference. And I think the last point in this slide will make that clear. Yes.
The definition of the D-metric topology, are you assuming that M is saturated?
Yes, M is a monster model, so it realizes all types, and yeah, otherwise there's... right. Okay, so now we have to worry a little bit about what happens to these type spaces and topologies when we change parameter sets. So now I'm supposing that A and B are both small sets of parameters inside the highly saturated, the universal domain model M. And then, of course, there's a forgetful map from types over B to types over A. Just throw away the equations that involve the parameters that aren't in A. Now, this has some nice properties. It's trivial that it's surjective, right? If I have something that realizes a given type over A, it realizes some type over B, and that type maps to the given type under pi. So it's a surjective map. It's continuous for the logic topology. Well, in fact, if we take a type in the image, say P, and some phi epsilon neighborhood of it, then the phi epsilon neighborhood makes sense over B, and all the types in it will map into this neighborhood around P. So it's a continuous map. Right? The inverse image of an open neighborhood of a neighborhood is a neighborhood. Hence, it's open. Well, that's because of surjective and compact. So because it's surjective and compact, closed sets get mapped to closed sets, therefore open sets get mapped to open sets.
I
I don't think so. Are you sure this is the right argument?
Maybe not. I don't know. I'm never sure of anything.
You say my closed maps are open. This is what you claim. The closed maps are open.
It doesn't sound right when you put it that way. It's certainly closed.
Yeah.
It's closed. Maybe that's what I should say. Okay, for the D metric, it's obviously contractive. Right? If I imagine in the saturated model, when we have two types over B, imagine that we realize them by points that are as close as possible. Close together as possible. So the distance between the realizations is exactly the same as the distance between types. Well, then those same things realize the image type under pi. So the pi distance, if anything, is smaller. We might be able to find some realizations over the smaller set of parameters which were closer together. But certainly that's the only thing that could happen. So it's an isometrically contractive map, and therefore it's continuous. Now, an important case that has to do with Amador's question is, suppose the smaller set is dense in the given metric on M in the bigger set. Then what we have is actually very strong homeomorphism between the two type spaces. So it's an isometric a bijection in the case of and it's a homeomorphism for the logic topologies. And that is, again, a consequence of the uniform continuity of formulas. Right? It's the fact that the formulas are uniform continuous means that pi is a bijection. The image of any type over B is determined by its restriction to A, by continuity of formulas. So the way to tell whether some formula over B has value R in this type is to approximate the parameters arbitrarily closely by points from A and see whether the limit of the values is R. So that proves that pi is an isometry for the D metrics because it's bijective, and we already knew that it was contractive. Yeah. I mean, it's right. Not because it's just because it's bijective, but it's immediate that it's an isometry, and that it's a homeomorphism. The fact that it's continuous and closed, I guess, now does the trick. So in the these things all have, if you ever looked at the papers or the thesis of my student from 94, Jose Iavino, who developed stability for the norm space structures in the setting of positive bounded formulas, you'll find a very general and somewhat complex to understand description of possible topologies on type spaces. These are two of the important ones. There are others in general. In order to make these last facts, especially 6 and 7, true, the topologies considered have to be restricted in certain ways. They have to be tied to the logic in ways that are too complicated. I'm not going to try to describe them here. I'm not sure I would remember all the postulates. But there are many other topologies in general that make sense to consider as topologies on types. Of course, structures from functional analysis come inevitably equipped with several topologies. You know, in a Banach space, for example, you not only have the norm topology, which is what gives rise to this D metric, but you also have the weak topology, which comes by taking the continuous linear functionals as defining basic neighborhoods, or more abstractly, you take the coarsest topology with respect to which all the continuous linear functionals are continuous. And this is another topology. And there are also isomorphism-based topologies. For example, if I have a theory of norm space and I look at some monster model of it, so a norm space is a perfectly good metric structure as long as we think of it in a many-sorted way. Each ball becomes a sort of the structure, or equivalently, just work on the unit ball. Just restrict everything to the unit ball of the norm space. Then there are topologies coming from isomorphic as opposed to isometric equivalents. So I can look on the monster model and regard elements or their types as being lambda close to each other, where lambda is some number bigger than one. If there's a lambda isomorphism of the monster model to itself, it takes one tuple to the other. And by a lambda isomorphism, I mean a linear homeomorphism whose norm is less than or equal to lambda, so it doesn't distort the norm by more than a factor of lambda, and the same for its inverse. Well, this doesn't give quite a metric because the distance is bigger than or equal to one, and it doesn't satisfy the additive form of the triangle inequality, but rather the multiplicative one. So if I take the logarithm of this lambda, I get a metric in the usual sense. This is called the Banach-Moser metric in various forms. Banach-Moser distance between, in this case, between types. And this is another metric which in the Banach space setting, metric on types, deserves to be in the picture. Okay, so I'm nearly out of time, is that right? Again?
8 minutes,
good. I've got just enough for 8 minutes. But not on slides. Can this thing go up? Does anybody know how to do that?
You have a little pad there to the left.
Oh, a little pad.
Press on the fingers with chalk. There's something that says, there's a drawing of a little chalk. Drawing
box. I see an overhead projector. No. I don't see any chalk. I see exit. I see Crayola. Is that it?
I think the Crayola.
Who would have guessed? That's very playful. Okay. It's a picture of kids' crayons, right? The box of kids' crayons. That's
for that.
I don't know. Is that very British? It doesn't seem very British to me.
Chalk sound.
Yes. Maybe that's it. It's colored chalk, not... okay, it's not for kids. All right. So one thing that's quite clear about what I've said so far, or what I've presented, is that there are no examples. Or maybe one, which was kind of not the point, because the example I gave was how to take an ordinary model from first order logic and make it into a metric structure. If that's all we were doing, I can tell you I wouldn't do it. But we've talked about norm spaces. All of you know metric spaces that you like and maybe even love. There are two examples that are going to come up in what happens later. And I want to just show them to save time on Monday. Okay, so this is probability structures. So Alex Bernstein is going to give the Tuesday morning talk, and this is the content. I mean, this is the subject area: probability structures with automorphisms. So he and I have finished a paper about these things. Itai Benyakov wrote a paper about probability structures by themselves, which he playfully called Schrödinger's cat. I think he has the wrong idea of what Schrödinger did, but that's okay. which is about the model theory of probability structures and carefully lays out axiomatization and stability-related facts. Okay, so let's suppose that we have a probability space. So by this I mean that omega is some non-empty set, B is a sigma algebra on omega, and mu is a sigma additive measure on B, so defining a measure value for all elements of B, which has its values, 0 in the empty set, 1 on omega, and other values in between. So it's a 0, 1 valued probability measure. Mu of omega equals 1. So this is not a metric structure, but we can take B hat to be B modulo mu null sets. So the measure algebra of this probability space. And we can define a metric D, so D of AB. I really should say equivalence class of A, equivalence class of B. This is defined to be mu of the symmetric difference. So delta denotes the symmetric difference, the things that are in one set but not the other. This defines a metric when put on B hat. But since different elements of an equivalence class, a mu null set equivalence class, since different elements differ by a set of measure zero, that doesn't change what's on the right-hand side. So this is a well-defined metric on B hat. And so the probability structures that we'll be considering will be M equals B hat with this metric D. So I don't mention it in specifying a structure for exactly the same kind of reason that one doesn't specify equality when mentioning an ordinary model. Now, you could say, there's only one equality on a set, but there are lots of metrics. That's a fair comment. Okay, so what operations do we take? Well, there's intersection, union, and complement, which are well defined on the measure algebra. And then constants 0 and 1, so the image of the empty set and the full set omega under the quotient map to B hat. And then mu itself as a predicate. Right, so this is what we call a probability structure. And we show, first of all, that these, so this is equals. We show that these can be axiomatized. That's not too hard, although it does use some universally findable facts about measure algebras. I only know of one place where they're all written down. That's a book of a translated book, one of the Kluver translated books from Russian by Vladimirov that's referenced in our list of references. So among the things that you have to prove is that if you have a complete metric space that sort of looks like it might be one of these, so it satisfies the axioms that you would write down, that it is actually, that it arises in this way. Also, there's some subtle difference between the completeness that such a thing has and metric completeness. It's not totally obvious that this would be a complete metric space, because the Cauchy sequences that you normally consider when thinking about sigma additivity of the measure are not perfectly general. They're not perfectly general Cauchy sequences. They might be increasing in the order or decreasing in the order, something like that. So there's actually a little work to do to prove that this is a complete metric space. All right, so in particular, the theory that we study that Alex will partly talk about is the theory of such structures when the measure is atomless, when every set in B, every set of positive measure can be cut into subsets of strictly less positive measure. So this turns out to be very nice, separably categorical, stable theory. And you wouldn't be too surprised to find that the independence relation for this theory is essentially the same as probabilistic independence. That's what Itai noticed. And the other example is L1 spaces. So now we have, say, X E mu is a measure space, not generally required to be finite or even sigma finite, so a very general metric space. And we look at L1 of this space. Well, so this is the set of all functions from x to the reals. I'll take the real case, such that, so f is E measurable, and the integral over x of the absolute value of f d mu is finite, and the norm is that integral. Now, this is not a bounded metric space, right? And the metric structures are supposed to be based on a bounded metric space. So here our model consists of the unit ball, B1. So this is the collection of elements of that space that have norm less than or equal to 1. And now we want to put on it the structure of a normed space. But of course, we can't take general addition or other vector operations because they go outside the unit ball. So the thing to do is to take the functions alpha f plus beta g. So these are convex combinations or absolutely convex combinations where the scalars satisfy that inequality. So that means that the norm of such a thing is still less than or equal to 1. So this is the this is what counts on this unit ball for the vector space operations. And then, well, we can name 0 and take the norm as a predicate. So this is the structure that one would take just motivated by the norm space, Banach space structure of this space. It's also useful to consider this as a lattice ordered, a partially ordered Banach space, where you simply take the pointwise ordering operations. And again, you have to be a little careful, because if you take the meter join, even of positive things, it can, the norm can jump to up to as much as 2. So one possibility is to take the absolute value and the positive part and the negative part as additional operations. Those are those take the unit ball into themselves, and essentially anything else that you want can be constructed from these. In fact, the absolute value is redundant, of course, because the positive part plus the negative part equals the absolute value. Right, so we have the positive part and the negative part simply mean the restriction of the function to where it's positive, or minus the restriction to where it's negative. So the function can be written as f plus minus f minus, and the absolute value is written as f plus plus f minus. So this is also a structure that, well, it's there's a the 13th section, I guess, of our notes. Applies to these. It summarizes some work that Alex and I and Itai Ben Yaakov have done together.
In the case of separable places, separable. Is it true that in a way you can pass really to countable language? Let's say you only allow, instead of a general epsilon 1 over n, and you only allow those polynomial connectors, and you only allow, what else? And you only allow parameters from this dense subset. You get the same expressive power, right? You get the same, what you call definable predicates, same type space.
Right. Without the issue of parameters, there's a discussion of that in section 6 of our notes, which I'm not talking about at all, which gives a very, very thin set of connectives in terms of which everything and all the other connectives can be approximated, which gives things like maximum, minimum, absolute value of difference, a few other things that we need along the way. It's based on this subtraction for positive numbers, where the special minus, that it shows up in computability theory sum as well. This x special minus y is x minus y if it's non-negative, and it's 0 otherwise. So that's a connective. That's a continuous function of two variables. And that's one of the basic connectives that it's a kind of implication for this logic. That's the point of view toward that connective that was taken in the pre-1960 period when the propositional logic of this setting was being studied.
Three forty,
in other words. Or 1540, if you will. Yeah, exactly. It's really nice. Yeah, no, it's neat. It's very neat. Yeah, that's the deal.